You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, Germany's finance minister tells Greece to make up its mind over the future of its debt repayments as negotiations to ease austerity in the country come to a standstill. We'll discuss that and more of the day's key news stories from around the world with Nina Schick of the Open Europe think tank and with Roger Boys, diplomatic editor for the Times of London. Also ahead, we'll assess the architectural legacy of Scotland's most celebrated artist, Charles Rennie Mackintosh, and ask why many of his visionary architectural designs were never built.
I think he was both ahead of his time, but also very much had his feet in several ponds. If you look for an Art Nouveau figure in the United Kingdom, then Mackintosh is the man to go to.
And before the end of the programme...
Now I'm 4 or 5 seconds from wildin', and we got 3 more days till Friday.
We'll review the latest music releases with Billboard's Gary Trust live in New York City. All that and much more besides coming up right here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A busy show in prospect then. Before we start, let's get the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News with Jonathan Wheatley. Eurozone finance ministers say they expect Greece to request an extension of its bailout by the end of the week. Talks in Brussels ended without a deal after the Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis rejected the wording of a draft document which proposed a 6-month extension of existing terms which included austerity policies. But he insisted he was still prepared to work with the international creditors.
I'm very excited about this. Investment is the main game in Europe. It's what is going to defeat the deflationary forces which are blowing ill winds everywhere in the continent. And just like the European Central Bank is the pillar of monetary stability, I believe the European Investment Bank is an excellent pillar for growth and investment and recovery in Europe.
The Ukrainian military says that pro-Russian rebels are fighting to seize a strategic rail station in the town of Debaltseve, but Ukrainian troops still control the transport hub. Pro-Russian rebels shelled government troops every 5 seconds today, despite the truce that has eased fighting in many areas since the European brokered deal took effect on Sunday. Christians attended mass prayers in Cairo's St. Mark's Coptic Orthodox Cathedral today after an Islamic State group in Libya released a video showing the beheading of 21 Egyptian Christians. Egypt has urged other countries to join it in targeting Islamic State in Libya, which is largely without a government as differing factions claim control of different regions. Well, Monocle's contributor in Tunis, Navina Kotor, says there are worries in Libya's neighbour Tunisia that IS may spread further west.
There's a worry that because the Libyan and Tunisian border is, it's fairly easy for Libyans to cross into Tunisia and for Tunisians to cross into Libya, that Libya could become a sort of a place where Tunisian jihadists could go, train and come back. There's also a concern here among the public that Libyans could cross over and plan attacks here. So this is really, this is a serious concern.
At least 3 bomb explosions killed 8 people at a military checkpoint in the northeastern Nigerian town of Bayu on Tuesday, witnesses and a hospital source said. The military fired back on the attackers and killed 17 insurgents. Bayu has been repeatedly attacked by Islamist militant group Boko Haram, and the use of multiple bombs planned to go off in quick succession is a trademark tactic of the jihadists. And Bayer Mohammed, one of the Al Jazeera journalists released on bail in Egypt last week after 411 days in prison, says he's confident that a retrial will find him not guilty of charges of helping the banned Muslim Brotherhood. He was arrested back in December 2013 and jailed last year along with 2 colleagues, Mohamed Fahmy, who was released with him pending retrial, while Peter Grester was freed and deported on the 1st of February. The new trial is due to start next Monday, and Bayer Mohammed says a precious principle is at stake.
I was doing this for the freedom of press. This is the main thing we were discussing, me and Peter and Fahmy, through every night, why we are doing this. We should be strong, we should always stay strong. Don't be afraid of anything. We are doing it for a bigger cause, for a bigger principle. This is the most important thing.
And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 5 minutes past six, almost 6 minutes past six, 13:06 in New York City. Joining me with their take on today's big news stories in the Studio One are both Nina Schick of the Open Europe think tank here in London and Roger Boyce, diplomatic editor for the Times of London. Welcome to you both. Great to have you with us on the programme. In Berlin a few hours ago, the German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, has said that Greek negotiators need to make up their minds in negotiations to soften austerity in the country following the victory of left-leaning Syriza party in Greece late last month. Negotiations between the sides came to a something of a standstill late on Monday night. Nina, perhaps I'll start with you. Wolfgang Schäuble said, "None of my colleagues understands what Greece wants. Whether Greece itself knows is not clear either." Do you think Greece really don't know what they want? Or is that Schäuble being a bit sort of cheeky, perhaps?
Well, of course, Greece, as Syriza, is trying to stick to the election promises of, you know, ending the austerity program. And several proposals have been floated. You know, they want a bridging deal until, you know, the current program ends in February. They want a bridging deal. But the thing here, the top line in this story is we had the Eurozone finance ministers meeting yesterday, and that meeting really descended into farce. And the top line is that it's basically Greece versus the rest of the Eurozone. The rest of the Eurozone has said that Greece must continue and must ask for an extension of its current bailout program, and nothing else will be accepted. So now, of course, we expect Schäuble to take that line on Greece. But the interesting thing is, never before have you seen European countries, Rome, Paris, Berlin, so united on their stance on Greece. So Greece doesn't really have much room for play here.
Roger, would you go along with that? Do you think it is now Greece versus the rest? We've talked about different rifts and divides, you know, within the Eurozone, north v south, debtor versus creditor. Do you think they're finding themselves, I don't know, painted into a corner, really?
Yes, I do. And we've been writing for ages, you know, that Europe is being ripped apart, north and south, east and west at the moment. But actually, it isn't really just north and south, because you're getting lots of southern countries that have made loads of sacrifices and are now vehemently against Greece, you know, being let off the hook. So you have Portugal, you know, you have Spain, you have Italy, all absolutely up in arms that some kind of, get out of jail free card could be presented to Greece. So that's quite an important moment, that it's actually not a north-south divide. It's not even a creditor nation versus debtor nation. It's actually something about rules, and also perhaps a pedagogic element too. The sense that the Syriza government has somehow to stay in the club, has to somehow grow up. Yeah, of course, no one says that out publicly or aloud. But the truth is, the closer you look at the Syriza program, the more disastrous it is. Yeah, anything that really that they're proposing, which could seriously improve the Greeks, the Greek economy's ability to flourish or survive, is negated by their policies. You know, Greece has to privatize, you know, and Greece cannot re-employ all those state employees that were cut under the Samaras government. So it has to stay competitive, and it has to get itself out of the mess, as well as EU getting itself, or the Eurozone getting it out of its mess.
Nina, that's interesting. I mean, if Greece does indeed have to sort of, you know, grow up, as Roger describes it there, what if there's a reticence or a simple unwillingness to do that? We edge towards this, you know, bailout key date, 28th of February. What happens if we reach that point? And they remain unwilling to do so. What happens then?
Well, they just don't have much room for leverage because, as we already mentioned, their bailout runs out at the end of this month. And what the rest of the Eurozone and the institutions, including the European Commission and the IMF, has said is we will give you until Friday to say that you're willing to talk to us within these parameters, so extending the existing bailout program. And then only we can take these negotiations further. So apart from that, if they don't agree to that, then they would have to leave the Eurozone. And the interesting thing is that analysts, including, you know, my own think tank, thinks that the risk of Greece leaving the Euro at this stage is actually higher than what it was in 2012 at the height of the Eurozone crisis then. However, I don't think that will be the ultimate outcome. I think what will happen is some kind of extend and pretend. Maybe the rest of the Eurozone will water down some of the rhetoric and the kind of draft conclusion so that Syriza can, you know, appease some of the further left wing of its party. But aside from that, I do not think that Varoufakis and Tsipras can deliver the election promises that they made to their electorate.
Of course, there are different tricks that Syriza can play. One is a referendum, for example. But then, of course, the question, as we know on referendums, is always hinges on the question. So it could be a question about the bailout, or it could be a question... I suppose about Eurozone membership at all. Anyway, there are a number of ways that Syriza can escalate. They are, you know, it's I've got to admire their brinkmanship. It's just incredible, and I think they will take this. I think they will take it beyond February 28th. I think people will start to panic, and they're gambling that something happens. Out of sheer panic that something gets fixed for them.
I wanted to pick up on something you mentioned about this idea of, you know, sticking to the plans and the importance of reiterating that when it comes to Greece. You go back over 10 years now to when Germany themselves were fairly flexible, shall we say, with the growth and stability pact rules. And obviously at that point there was a willingness to be very accommodating. A different landscape, of course, now. But it's quite tough, isn't it, Nina, for the Greeks, who will surely look back on that and say, well, you know, you were willing to be flexible then, and, you know, we got a mandate to not to continue with this austerity program. In our view, it's failed objectively within Greece. So why would we do anything other than this?
Of course, one has sympathy for the Greek people. I mean, they've really suffered over the past few years. However, as Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister, repeatedly points out, it's not just democracy in Greece, but it's also democracy in the rest of Europe. So they're also beholden to their own domestic electorates. You can't imagine Merkel going to the German public and saying, now that you hold, you know, this much of Greek debt, we're just going to simply write it off. And that's what other Eurozone finance ministers have been saying as well. Just because this is a democratic expression in Greece, we can't ignore our own domestic electorates.
One of the weird paradoxes is that a left-wing populist government, if it manages somehow to maneuver some kind of write-off, will lead to a reaction from right-wing populists in Germany. It's just such a muddle and such a phase of craziness now that. But of course, it's absolutely right that electorates are interacting and they're furious. You know, the anger with Greece in Germany is really quite big and has been for quite a number of years.
I think it doesn't help when, you know, some of the newspapers have been characterizing Wolfgang Schäuble as a Nazi and so on. And he even mentioned that today, saying that, you know, he talked to Varoufakis about it and they had no problem with each other personally. But this and we saw it when Varoufakis was on his tour of Germany last week. You know, there were constant references to Nazism. And as a German myself, I know that doesn't go down very well in Germany. It doesn't seem like a fair hit, if you will.
Just one final thing I wanted to ask. We're hearing these interesting numbers about the billions of euros leaving Greek banks day by day, 2 billion euros a day. Several things struck me as rather interesting about that. One was, I was surprised that there was that much money in Greek banks still in the first instance. And also, Nina, and I don't know if you can shed some light, what happens if they literally run out of money in the meantime? I mean, this is a very real threat, supposedly. What happens if that happens?
Oh, yes. So they have access to emergency liquidity funding from the European Central Bank. But the European Central Bank has said, you know, they won't provide this anymore unless some kind of conclusion is made. So it's a very real thing that Greece could be left without money, which is why Syriza doesn't have time on its side and it doesn't have any partners on its side either.
Let's move on and talk a little about Ukraine next. Battles on the ground have continued between government forces and fighters loyal to Moscow, despite the ceasefire between the two sides that was announced in Minsk last week. All the while, Western governments are continuing to grapple with the question of whether to arm those forces loyal to Kiev as the crisis continues. Roger, if we don't arm Ukraine, what meaningfully can we do? And given that there doesn't seem to be any real appetite to do that, is there no real option left for people at the moment?
Yeah, I think that's a very good summary of the present situation. We shouldn't conflate different time periods. And arming Ukraine, I mean, first of all, the Ukrainian army is armed. But mainly the US can bilaterally arm Ukrainian army, but over time, and it will have to train them, and it will be a period of 6-8 months. And it can actually feed into, perhaps, a reasonable outcome of this crisis towards the end of the year, because a lot of the problems have been backloaded in the Merkel-Hollande negotiation. We've more or less now, it's a bit ragged, it's very ragged at the moment still, but probably by the end of next week, we'll have some kind of sustainable ceasefire. But all the big issues, or the biggest issue of all, is closing the border, closing the Russian-Ukrainian border, monitoring it, policing it, and making sure that these autonomous areas, largely autonomous areas of eastern Ukraine, don't become little Russian protected cantons. Now, all that requires probably some kind of United Nations protection over and beyond the OSCE people at the moment, but it also requires a highly mobile, highly effective Ukrainian army to defend its own border with Russia. And that's where the arming comes in. It's not just, you know, shoveling guns at them and saying, look, go off and shoot Russians. It's more complex than that. It's about restoring the self-confidence of a sovereign state's army in its pursuit of defending its own border and guarding its own border. And that seems to me a perfectly legitimate thing to do. It sounds like it's sort of needlessly provocative, but actually it's a completely logical piece of policy making. Otherwise, what else is there to do? Well, we can ratchet up sanctions if Russia continues to subvert or dismember Ukraine in a covert way. But actually, my feeling is that probably Russia won't do this, not for a while anyway, that it's actually going to just freeze the conflict now for a few months.
Well, I might ask you about next steps for Putin and Russia in a moment, but just on that idea, I mean, implicit in what Roger was saying then, Nina, is this idea of monitoring, whether it's in the short term to see that the conditions of this agreement are being observed, or in the longer term, perhaps involving the UN or others. Germany said there are concrete measures in place to ensure observers can monitor, but it's fairly hard to see what those concrete measures are. Members of the OSCE have not been able to get some of these key strategic towns. Do you have any confidence that there's any, you know, more positive outlook as regards that situation?
I think this situation will just continue to simmer on as it has done for many, many months now. So I think that Putin has basically got the upper hand here, and he has what he wants in eastern Ukraine. If his aim was to destabilize Ukraine, to ensure that it doesn't get closer ties to the West, and then that has been successful. And part of the reason this conflict started is because Ukraine was put in a position where it had to choose between the EU or Russia. And because this has become so tied up with his own personal prestige, I think that there is no way for Putin to simply back down and pull out of Ukraine. So I don't think that is even an option. And I think that people, especially like Merkel, are very, you know, are well aware of that. And she, of course, Germany is also very hesitant to send arms to Ukraine because they think that that might be a pretext for Russia to send in more forces, for the border to remain porous. So I think what we'll see is a continuation of what we've been seeing right now. Perhaps the EU will ratchet up the sanctions. But that, again, has not been effective. If the aim of those sanctions were to prevent Putin from his boisterous band of nationalism in Ukraine, you know, that that hasn't been effective. So I think we're going to continue seeing more of the same.
Roger, just to pick up on that point you made, though, about sort of, you know, freezing the situation. I mean, why exactly do you think that's the likely course for Putin? Is it a lack of appetite on his behalf for the sort of nuts and bolts of this particular confrontation, or is it something maybe more of a strategic position?
Well, I think he's stopped because he's wanted to stop, not because we've deterred him from doing anything. And I think he's flipped us. He, just as he flipped Obama in 2013 on Syria, he smelled Obama was reluctant to use force against Syria and flipped it. It's a similar thing now with the arming of the Ukrainian rebels. He sensed that Obama was not completely at ease with it, and suddenly you get an offer of some kind of conversation. Merkel is poised because she's had endless pre-discussions with him. It works that way. He's flipped it. He's frozen the conflict. He wants to move on. And my thesis is that he wants to move on to Asia. I think that there is something going on there that actually, there is, of course, the theory that he wants to freeze Ukraine and move on to Moldova and all these other places. But there's no actual evidence for that. That's just what people are worried about. But the evidence points to him actually being concerned more about Central Asia and about Kazakhstan, all these countries. There's with the withdrawal of the American troops from Afghanistan, there's a space opening up there, strategic space. He's worried very much. Kazakhstan, a third of them are Slavic speaking, of Slavic background. And he is worried that the leader there, Nazarbayev, will die, that there'll be some kind of turmoil, that the West or America will try and position themselves, and that he's worried that he's going to have endless Ukraines. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He's got Ukraine, but he's worried that Kazakhstan will turn into Ukraine, other places will turn into Ukraine. So he's looking towards Asia. He's inviting the Chinese leader to come to Moscow in May, Korean leader too, endless possibilities there. He's holding a BRICS summit. He's going to hold a Shanghai Cooperation summit. He wants a whole Asian summer, and that's beginning to unfold now. And he doesn't want to mess around with Ukraine. He's quite happy to have Ukraine calm down just for a few more months.
The insights there of Roger Boyce, diplomatic editor of the Times of London, Nina Schick, of course, from the Open Europe think tank. They'll both stay with me. When we return after a short break, we'll assess the diplomatic relationship between Egypt and France, and we'll ask whether negotiators should smile more. Stay with us.
Every March, Monocle puts the spotlight on one nation, and this time, it's the turn of Japan. As the country looks forward to welcoming the world at the 2020 Olympic Games, we focus on the challenges facing modern Japan. Here's what our editors have reported on.
In the design section, we trek the length and breadth of Japan to discover its craft capitals, those towns known in true Japanese style for making one thing and making it well.
In the edits pages, we follow the Sumida River to Tokyo's old town to profile the up-and-coming Kuramai neighbourhood.
The March issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or become a subscriber. Head to monocle.com to find out how.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 1823 here in London. Still with me, Nina Schick of the Open Europe think tank here in London, and Roger Boyce, diplomatic editor for the Times of London. Now, earlier today it was announced that Egypt and France had finalised a deal worth over 5 billion euros. The deal comes a day following signs that the two nations are strengthening their diplomatic relations too. France joined Egypt in calling for the UN Security Council to debate the killing of 21 Egyptian Christians by militants in Libya over the weekend. Roger, let me ask you, what was your sort of response to news of this deal? The French Defence Minister Le Drian has said our two countries are pursuing a common struggle against terrorism. Is that what this is about, or is it a simple bit of, you know, trusty arithmetic, financial and political?
Well, the first thing that strikes me is that Egypt, which was pretty much a pariah, really, in the West, is now refashioning itself. Partly with French assistance, but actually there is a more general, Sisi has actually talked to Cameron as well, so There is some rehabilitation, and it follows a speech that he made on January the 1st, in which he quite clearly distanced himself from Islamic extremism in very clear terms, which impressed a lot of people, which was the talk of Davos, for example, this year. He's freed some of the Al Jazeera people, prisoners, and is cooperating on a more or less daily basis with Israel against terrorists in Sinai. So all these things suggest that actually, there was a suspicion always military dictator, restoration of a kind of Mubarak, where are we going? And of course, there are still lots of democratic pitfalls in the Sisi government, not least their courts, their disastrous court system. But the truth is, Egypt used to be always a leader in the Middle East. It used to have a leading role in the Middle East. And we've suddenly realized, not just France, but we in general have suddenly realized that we are missing that. We're missing a regional leader in the Middle East at the moment. And that Sisi is capable of it, or at least we're sufficiently desperate to believe that Sisi is capable of it. And so that's what's happening. You will find, I think, that this will be one of the global trends of the year, that we will look to the African Union to help fight Boko Haram in northeast Nigeria, for example. We'll look for a regional solution, and we will look for a regional solution to Libya. And Egypt should lead that regional solution. And I think that's what's going to happen. France, of course, has good track record. It was in Mali. It's very good at hitting things and then getting out again. Egypt has a very strong vested interest in securing the Egyptian-Libyan border. But we will see how far this goes, whether it's just about creating a buffer zone between Egypt and Libya, for example, or whether there's something more fundamental. Certainly Europe has an intrinsic, really existential interest in a proper functioning Libya and not a chaotic one where millions of people are passing through it, hundreds of thousands of people are passing through it to cross the Mediterranean into Europe.
Nina, is that your reading of it in terms of the view from Paris? That's really what is at the heart of this sort of agreement.
Well, as someone who's very aware of the state of the French budget and the state of the French economy, the economic doldrums they're facing, of course, there was a little bit of skepticism when this news first came out. And it's not the first time that France has made a deal like this, even during the heights of the Ukraine crisis. And even after, MH17 was shot down, they were still trying to sell battleships to Russia. But having said that, I do agree with Roger, and it's for me the most interesting part of this story, at least from the EU perspective, is how France is continuing to take a leadership role in EU foreign policy. And one wonders when one sees Hollande's and Merkel's efforts also in Ukraine, where the UK is, because of course that is traditionally one of the things, even though the UK has always been a hesitant member of the EU, that at least in terms of foreign policy, especially in North Africa and the Middle East, it has taken a lead. But Cameron's been very quiet recently.
Mm. I don't want to talk about moral responsibilities too much, but the fact is that we were together with the French on the original Libyan intervention, which eventually got rid of Gaddafi, and which we both, Britain and France, deemed to be a success. Well, it wasn't a success, or at least it wasn't a success in any length of time. And we didn't embark on any kind of nation building. And France, I would like to think France sort of acknowledges that, and it's time that Britain did too.
Let's just ask you both before you depart about Iran's supreme leader, reportedly given the country's foreign minister some tips ahead of the latest round of negotiations on its contested nuclear programme. His key words of wisdom were that the Iranian negotiators shouldn't shout while discussing the nuclear programme, which seems fairly sensible, but they should smile more. Roger, you've got a keen understanding of diplomacy at these levels. Is it all in a smile?
Yeah, the Iranian nuclear bomb, what's not to smile about? I mean, I'm so amazed that the Supreme Leader has a sense of humour that I'm just absolutely flabbergasted about this. And my impression is that smiles are actually more ambiguous than non-smiles. And I think nothing would scare me more if someone like Putin started to smile. So my advice to Mr. Zarif is just stick with that frown, because it's what we all understand.
Are you happy with a frown around the negotiating table, Nina?
I agree. I agree with Roger. I think I would be very spooked if I was negotiating nuclear negotiations and somebody was smiling at the table across me. Yeah.
If you're talking nuclear, keep it serious. That's a sensible note of advice on which to end. Nina Schick of the Open Europe think tank here in London, and Roger Boys, diplomatic editor for the Times of London. Thank you both very much for joining us on Midori House.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monocle 24.
Orlando, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll review the weekly news magazine offering from Italy. And before the end of the programme...
Hay engaños que por años ocultaron la verdad, hiriendo de dolor.
We'll review the latest music releases live in New York City. Before all of that, though, let's get the latest world news headlines. Here's Jonathan Wheatley.
Thanks very much. Eurozone finance ministers said today they expect Greece to request an extension of its bailout by the end of the week. Talks in Brussels ended without a deal after the Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis rejected the wording of a draft document. The Ukrainian military says that pro-Russian rebels are fighting to seize a strategic rail station in the town of Debaltseve, but Ukrainian troops still control the transport hub. Christians have attended mass prayers in Cairo's St. Mark's Coptic Orthodox Cathedral today after an Islamic State group in Libya released a video showing the beheading of 21 Egyptian Christians. And at least three bomb explosions have killed eight people at a military checkpoint in the northeastern Nigerian town of Biu on Tuesday. The military has fired back on the attackers and killed 17 insurgents. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. More news, of course, from Jonathan Wheatley at the top of the hour. 1900, your next bulletin here on the station. 1832 right now. It is 1632 in Rio de Janeiro, but it's to Italy that we look next. It's time to look at the weekly magazine offering from that corner of the world. Joining me today, I'm delighted to say, there you can hear him, rustling his magazines. It's Monocle's David Pleasant.
Hi, Tom.
How are you? Now, David, I should say, first of all, your rustling may be a little more awkward than normal, because you're essentially operating on a sort of one-armed basis.
That's it. I do have two hands, but the one hand is fairly limited as I had a cycling crash. So thank you for your sympathy, but I'll endeavour to carry on with the magazine
that's
review.
What we like. That's why we know and love you, David Pleasant, because your commitment to the cause. Let's jump into your stack of magazines then. Where should we start? L'Espresso, perhaps?
Yep, that's right. Well, they both have a very kind of parallel running story. So the nomination of new president of the Republic, Sergio Mattarella, some 2 weeks ago. Basically, the two different takes. And as you'd expect from these two magazines, from two, one centre-right, one centre-left, very kind of opposing sort of reaction to that. If we start with L'Espresso, it's a picture of Matteo Renzi and Sergio Mattarella, the new president, staring at each other in the face, sort of jovially, but it says two presidents, because of course Matteo Renzi is the president of the Chamber of Deputies, that's his official name, so it's two presidents staring at each other, and it's the byline is a head of state with allergies to the cult of personality, and is facing a prime minister who is used to being the protagonist and breaking norms. And it says basically they'll have to find a way to get on, and it's going to be a challenging relationship.
So this is very much the sense that these people are, as the cover depicts it, quite literally sort of facing off. It is going to be a relationship characterised by conflict or animosity, perhaps not words as strong as that.
Not so much in that they sort of maybe broadly might come from the same sort of political camp. Mattarella being certainly a left-wing person with a left-wing pedigree. But yeah, this kind of personality cult, the sort of showmanship, perhaps, of Matteo Renzi is being scrutinised. But saying that, this kind of piece is saying that Mattarella is kind of more reserved, kind of perhaps more procedural, him being a former judge, very respected anti-mafia judge during the 1990s. Although today there is news kind of contravening that he's decided to open up the presidential palace to the public for the first time in its history. So who knows?
Interesting. Well, and let's make that broad comparison, as you mentioned. That's L'Espresso. What about on Panorama? So tell us how they're sort of relating the story.
Yeah, well, Panorama, it's always intriguing, it being part of the Mondadori group, of course, part of Berlusconi's empire, how they treat political stories. They have decided to go with the front cover, and it says the Italian anomaly. This is because in real terms, and this magazine's very conscious of that, Berlusconi still does pull all the strings. And there's a picture here of Berlusconi rather shadily in the back seat.
The eminence grease,
exactly. Yeah, and this is a picture of him at the swearing-in of Sergio Mattarella, the head of state, at the presidential palace. So he's kind of doesn't look that pleased about what's happening. But as you'd imagine. So basically, the take from Panorama is that the people who want to put Berlusconi, but burn him at the stake, as it were, have to concede and realise that they're going to have to stop these kind of criminal proceedings against him if they want Berlusconi to kind of keep the status quo, which he sort of has to do.
And there's a certain ease. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, if you're reading Panorama or magazines from that stable, that there's a general ease of having, you know, Berlusconi depicted in this way. There's no sort of discomfort about, you know, the editorial voice or the fact that he is still this kind of spectre on the horizon across all of Italian politics. The readers of that magazine presumably happy to, want to read that almost.
Well, they're kind of conscious of that. And I think that also, if we look at this, it's sort of like this is a call to the directly to the left wing. You know, you're going to have to either treat him as a statesman or as a criminal, referring to Berlusconi. So it's like asking the left, you know, you decide, how do you want to treat this man? So, you know, there's obviously some sort of support for Berlusconi. This is in the editorial. This is his company, after all.
So perhaps we shouldn't be too surprised, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly.
And what about delving inside, David? Any other sort of things that caught your eye from your sort of the browse through that you've had this week?
I thought if we went back to the Espresso, there's a really interesting sort of binary two-piece kind of look at working life in Italy. There's a kind of really good piece with some interesting infographics. This is entitled "Welcome Back the Do Nothing." The Fannullone is this kind of cult figure in Italian working life, the person who does nothing. Some people might have heard of dolce far niente. It's very important Italian saying. It means sweet doing nothing, you know, like the culture of really putting your feet back and doing not much at all. So they're looking.
And it's welcome back, is that the term?
Yeah, the rise in absenteeism and more and more people taking sick days in Italy. And they've really analysed it city by city, which cities are the worst offenders.
I love a good infographic. So who's the worst offenders then, Dave, when it comes to this?
It's a little bit cliched maybe, but it has to be. It's a city in the south, the capital of Calabria. Catanzaro has the most sick days per capita. Venice does really well. And then everywhere, all the other cities are about the same, but it has to be said, Venice, L'Aquila, the earthquake struck city, maybe they've got plenty of work to do, so they're not taking many sick days in Aquila. But it is quite a serious, in-depth look. Apparently, this costs the Italian economy somewhere between, 11,189,000,000 euros per year.
One imagines that they can ill afford at this time.
Exactly.
So I wonder, is the tone of that piece, is it sort of not despairing exactly, or is it sort of, you mentioned the sort of almost fondness for this notion of...
Yeah, it's in songs, it's in music.
Is it sort of, celebratory almost in a way, or is it a bit more like, look, you know, this is a real problem?
No, I think it's a little bit of a critique, although there's a sort of graphic of a man in a hammock, he's in a bow tie, and he's just
nothing. He looks pretty relaxed.
Yeah, he's pretty relaxed. But I think there is quite conscious here that this is really harming for the Italian economy. And interestingly, the next piece, obviously tied into that, is, and the article say it starts, but at the same time, bigger bonuses for everybody. So this is the rise. Absenteeism is going up in Italy, but actually bonuses for those lucky enough to have jobs, and you know, from surgeons to high-ranking state employees and so on, that they bonus culture is on the up.
It's booming. That's interesting. That kind of counterintuitive, counterintuitive almost. I would say.
Yeah, exactly.
Fascinating. Any other things caught your eye this week? Panorama?
In Panorama, there is quite. I mean, this going back to the kind of cover story about Sergio Mattarella, that there's quite a kind of good look in depth about what kind of presidency we might expect out of him. And just a funny little kind of play on words, sarà un'Italia Mattarella, which kind of playing on his surname, and Mattarello, the masculine, means a little bit crazy. So they're saying, is it going to be a slightly crazy Italy? Who knows? Probably still will be.
Okay, well, we'll have to wait and see, and we'll chart the progress in the weekly titles as well as the daily ones, hopefully in the company of David Pleasant. Once again, David, thanks for being on Midori House. Plenty still to come on today's edition of the programme. Up next, we're considering the work of one of Scotland's most celebrated architects. Stay tuned.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Time to enjoy some culture. And our next guest has actually strolled, well, only a couple of blocks away from Reba, round the corner here in London, the Royal Institute of British Architects. A great new exhibition about Charles Rennie Mackintosh. Mackintosh Architecture is its name, and its curator is Susan Pugh, who joins us here in the studio right now. Susan, welcome to Midori House. Thanks for coming to see us.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about, we'll talk about the specifics, I guess, of the exhibition in a moment, but people will sort of say, oh yes, of course, Charles Rennie Mackintosh, you know, one of the great names, celebrated worldwide. But I guess this exhibition is in part looking at the fact that that doesn't quite tell the whole story, certainly not when it comes to the view, the popular view, if you like, of Mackintosh during his lifetime.
No, I think probably he's more, almost possibly more known to the public generally, sort of as a designer, furniture and so on, and how his style has been sort of taken and almost made into this sort of Mackintosh merchandise. So I think people may be more familiar with him in that context rather than as particularly as an architect. So this exhibition really looks specifically as him as an architect, as his training as a student actually at the Glasgow School of Art, and then his role within the practice of Honeyman and Kepi, and then when he later became a partner in that practice as well, so Honeyman, Kepi and Mackintosh.
Now, a lot of people, I guess, particularly if they're familiar with Glasgow, you know, it feels like you're more familiar with his works because you actually see the buildings when it comes to the architectural practice. Do you think he's one of these, I mean, he's a bit of a visionary, sort of a polymath. Mm-hmm. Was he one of these people who's maybe ahead of his time to a degree? Or why do you think he didn't manage to secure that sort of legacy during his lifetime?
I think he was both ahead of his time, but also very much had his kind of, almost his feet in several ponds. I mean, you could say that sort of a lot of his work was inspired by arts and crafts movement sort of prior to his own sort of period. He was also very much part of Art Nouveau, that was not so much common, well, prevalent in the UK, but if you look for an Art Nouveau figure in the United Kingdom, then Mackintosh is the man to go to. But then he also has elements of Art Deco within his work, particularly sort of his later works. And then you can also argue that he's a bridge towards modernism. So in that way, he really covers a lot of architectural styles and periods. So I think he's both a design icon and also a bit of an enigma, because you can't really pinpoint or pinhole him, really.
Now, tell me, a lot of people say, "Oh, you know, he's known as a great draftsman, sort of, you know, wielder of the pen." If people actually go to the exhibition, will they be surprised perhaps by some of the things that are on display? Are there different, I don't know, facets? You mentioned this sort of multifaceted, but are there other facets perhaps that people won't be so familiar with, which might surprise them in terms of what they see there?
I think just the focus on him as an architect is perhaps slightly more surprising. We don't feature the sort of any of his furniture, or a little bit in terms of interior design. We look at his house for an art lover design, which he may have done partly with the inspiration of his wife, Margaret MacDonald, but it focuses on him as an architect. But it's definitely a fantastic opportunity to see some of his exquisite draftsmanship, the perspectives we've got. His sort of first big work within the practice was the Glasgow Herald building, and that's a very striking perspective where he uses a low viewpoint, so you get a very dramatic view up the tower that he added onto the Glasgow Herald building. So that, alongside sort of other plans and a little bit of watercolour as well, but you'll definitely see his skills as a draftsman and how he's very different and how he's progressed. We also have a drawing from his student days at the Glasgow School of Art, where he did a design for a science and art museum. But there, it's, you wouldn't be able to pick it out otherwise as a Macintosh drawing. It's very much in the classical style, Beaux-Arts tradition, much more in keeping with sort of other trends of the time, and perhaps more in keeping with his later partner, John Keppie. So you will see sort of the progression from that more conventional style to his very stripped down architectural style and draftsmanship.
I think that sort of evolution is fascinating, isn't it? What do we know in terms of how, you know, Charles Rennie Mackintosh, how did he see himself? Did he understand that he was sort of bridging these different disciplines? Did he see himself as an architect or as an artist or as a designer? Is that important, I guess, when looking back at all of his work? Is it important to consider how he perceived himself?
I think it's definitely an interesting question. I don't know that we could answer the question in terms of style, stylistically, whether he would, I don't think he would have wanted to have sort of, you know, cornered himself into a particular style, but he definitely saw himself as an architect, and I think he was frustrated by the lack of recognition as a professional architect in his time. But equally, he did see himself as an artist, and later in his life he focused purely really on painting. And then there's the sort of an early portrait we have of him in the exhibition. It was taken by Annan Photographers, a very sort of popular at the time and successful photographic firm. And there he's deliberately sort of portraying himself as an artist with a sort of a smock-like tie and so on. So I think he liked to sort of consider himself as both, but I would say probably architect would have been his main drive.
Now, it's interesting, obviously, we're sitting here in London, you know, Reeborough is an august London institution. It's funny that Mackintosh's influence wasn't really felt, as we've already sort of alluded to, during his life as extensively as perhaps it might well have been. And in London, too, it never seemed to really sort of work for him. There's a lot of people who have said, oh, you know, Mackintosh could have had wielded a great influence in London if only he'd been given the opportunity. Was he denied opportunities, or was it something that just wasn't, you know, in the stars, as it were? Why do you think his influence wasn't felt in say, you know, the capital of Britain?
He did have some opportunities in London. I mean, he came here in 1915, actually, and lived here for a number of years before he moved to France. But he was commissioned to do some artist studios in Chelsea, and quite a number of buildings actually on one particular site, but mainly I think from sort of cost grounds that it never really materialised. There was a very small part was actually built, but nothing's recognisable as Mackintosh. So there were opportunities, but I would say probably finances, and also by that point, this is sort of about 1920, 1922, there was already a sort of change in fashion. People were looking a bit more to classicism and Beaux-Arts, and they weren't looking for that sort of individual element. So I think that probably was a big factor. And then also then perhaps his career would have taken off more prior to that, prior to coming to London when during the First World War. But again, that was a major, obviously played a major part in, I think, not being able to explore those options. He actually went to Suffolk, really for a period of respite and recuperation after he'd dissolved the partnership with Honeyman and Keppie. And then again, it would have, perhaps something would have materialised there, or he was actually looking to go on from Suffolk on to Europe, possibly Paris and Vienna, where his designs were being published and being recognised. But again, due to the war, that just couldn't happen.
Susan, I always sort of ask, if I'm talking to sort of, you know, curators or museum directors, this sort of thing, about personal favourites, and they will say, oh, it's very difficult to choose things. It's like choosing your own children or whatever. Uh-huh. But, you know, if you could sort of augment your personal collection, as it were, with something that features in the exhibition, is there anything, not that you would do that, of course.
Of course.
But are there any things that you just think, you know, you sort of stand marvelling to look at, or there's just something that where the detail fascinates you? Is there anything in particular?
There's a perspective in the exhibition of the Daily Record building that he produced, a watercolour, and again, just just the colours. He did glazed brick work on that building, and again, just the watercolour as he's done it. And it's a very dramatic, it's a very difficult, compact site within Glasgow. So to get that angle is nigh on impossible. So again, that sort of enhances his dramatic viewpoint, and that's a very striking work. So that would be a nice one to
have. That would be the pick. Well, yeah, you know, people are thinking of an elaborate and lavish present for you. That's maybe something to look at. And just a reminder, so Macintosh Architecture is the name. It's starting, it opens, I think,
The 18th of February, tomorrow, and it runs until the 23rd of May.
There you go. It's at Reba on Portland Place in London.
Mm-hmm, opens 7 days a week now.
There you go. That's Susan Pugh, a curator of Macintosh Architecture, and looks after the library drawings and archives at Reba, of course, as well. Susan, thanks for coming to tell us all about it here on Midori House. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, 10 minutes before the top of the hour. Plenty of time left then for our daily arts review. Today we're talking music, and I'm delighted to say we're joined on the line from New York City by Billboard magazine's Gary Trust. Gary, thanks for joining us on the programme from snowy New York. Trust all is well where you are. And well, let's start off by talking about, well, I think it might be a record-breaking gap between top 10 entries on the Billboard Hot 100. Tell us about the gap and about who's just broken that record.
Correct. It is someone who is quite familiar with making Billboard chart history, and he has done it again. It's Paul McCartney is back in the Billboard Hot 100's top 10 for the first time since 1986. So that's 29 years he's gone between top 10s. And that is a record for artists billed as an artist. So, you know, for all the history Paul McCartney has made before, he makes more, and is making more this week. And it's 4 or 5 seconds with Rihanna and Kanye West. So how crazy, too, that McCartney is as relevant as ever, 51 years after the Beatles' arrival. Here he is duetting with Kanye and Rihanna. It's an incredible testament to his adaptability and just his everlasting artwork.
Absolutely, Gary. Well, let me ask you just about that sort of stylistic turn then of that trio. It's pretty interesting. I mean, what do you make of it? Is it just about people who want to kind of line up next to, you know, one of the all-time greats? Or do you think that sometimes style-wise it actually takes acts, even, you know, contemporary acts, in an interesting new artistic direction as well?
Yeah, you know, if anything, I think it's more of a change music-wise for Kanye and Rihanna. I just really heard Rihanna sound that musically stripped down without all the production before, vocally as well. Kanye as well, he's singing. He sounds nice singing. Rihanna sounds great too.
Let's take a little listen, Gary. Let's play a little bit of it. So this is Summer 4 or 5 Seconds. Let's have a listen to it right now.
Now I'm 4 or 5 seconds from wildin', and we got 3 more days till Friday. I'm just trying to make it back home by Monday morning. I swear I wish somebody would tell me, ooh, that's all I want.
Woke up an optimist, sun was shining, I'm positive. Then I heard you was talking trash.
How about a mystery?
Hold me back, I'm about to spaz.
Yeah, I'm about 4 or 5 seconds from wildin'.
That's 4 or 5 seconds, Rihanna, Kanye West and Paul McCartney. I think you're right, Gary. If you sort of played that to somebody out in the street, I think they'd be hard pushed to identify probably any of the three people involved with it.
Yeah, and you know, my favorite stat about that song is that the last time Paul McCartney had a top 10 in 1986, Rihanna wasn't even born yet. So that's really how long ago it was.
Oh my God, I don't know about you, Gary, that makes me feel incredibly old. Let's move swiftly on then. Swiftly, indeed, to Taylor Swift. Tell us about what she's been up to.
Yeah, she has another, looks like another huge hit single from her album 1989, which isn't surprising at all, after A Blank Space and Shake It Off. Style is the new single. It's rising really quickly into the top 20 on the Billboard Hot 100. It looks like it could be in the top 10 very soon. She just released a video for it last week, and as huge as this album is, it's incredible to think that this is a third single, because I think quality-wise, it should be a first single from an album from so many other acts, and that to me just tells how talented and what a hot streak Taylor Swift is on right now. That she's giving us this song. It's also more of her new pop sound. It's even Shake It Off could be a little bit. You could see how maybe it has her country roots in it, but I think with Blank Space and especially Style, she has completely gone pop at this point. It's another great single.
Well, let's take a quick listen to it. This is some of Style from Taylor Swift.
I should just tell you to leave, cause I know exactly where it leads, but I watch us go round and round each time. You got that jean, jean, daydream, look in your eye, and I got that red lip, classic thing that you like, and then we go crashing down, we come back every time, cause we never go out of style, we never go out of style, you got
That was Style from Taylor Swift. Let's talk, Gary, next up about Manna and Shakira. Tell us about this one. It's sort of a Latin airplay chart is doing the big numbers.
Yeah, a little different than the other two songs. It's not quite the crossover hit that those are. It's also brand new. But this is a superstar pairing. As much as, say, Rihanna, Kanye, and Paul McCartney is a superstar pop collaboration, this is about as big as it gets in the Latin world to have Maná and Shakira team up. Really nice song. It's a pretty ballad. It's their first album in a couple of years. So you add Shakira to it, it just, again, ups the star power. And just a very pretty collaboration. It's, I'm not sure it'll cross over to pop audiences, but it debuts at number one on Billboard's Latin Airplay chart this week, which is pretty rare. And off to a great start, and just a really nice song. A little bit different from Shakira, given sometimes she's a little bit more up-tempo. But this really works. I think it's a really nice song.
Let's have a quick listen. Shakira, Maná, this is Mi Verdad.
Hay engaños que por años ocultaron la verdad, hiriendo de dolor.
Nice and gentle. That's Mi Verdad from Shakira and Maná. I'll probably go for the first couple that we had, Gary, of your picks. Like, to be honest, though, for me. But let's pick one more in just before at the end of the show. Drake, we've got a kind of surprise album, and we got a track Preach, which we're going to play in a minute. But just tell us about the surprise album. Where's this going to go? Is it going to soar straight to the top?
It looks like it is, and it looks like it's going to have more than 500,000 in sales in its first week here in the U.S. Which he's done with his last four albums. So anything Drake puts out is a huge seller right off the bat. What's different, obviously, about this one is it debuts with 4 days of sales. It was a surprise release last week. Everyone is calling it, obviously, pulling a Beyonce, since she did that last year. And that really is what he's done. It, all of a sudden, the album was out. It was on iTunes, selling incredibly well, and that's that just shows the following he has, and especially too without any prior promotion, without a single that's building at radio, for him to still have that same high sales level is incredible. It's actually on target to be the second bestseller of the past year, second only to Taylor Swift's 1989 in its first week.
Pretty impressive numbers. Thanks very much, Gary Truss from Billboard Magazine, for joining us and talking music today on Midori House. Let's just have a very quick listen to a little bit of one of the tracks from If You're Reading This, It's Too Late. This is a bit of Preach from Drake.
I'm in your state tonight. I might just break the bank tonight, yeah. P&D with the Ray-Tay, you know J-Ray. Got girls here going way, 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 way. Saga City trip to payday. Glowed up off a gateway, man, you can't afford me. Doing this one thing, doing it right is a whole different story. Niggas is all in their feelings these days. All in their feelings.
That is Preach from Drake from his surprise new album. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thanks to Nina Schick and Roger Boys, my special guests earlier. Thanks too to our producer Thomas Lewis, researchers David Pleasant and Stefano Fumigali, and our studio manager Bill Luti. Section D is up next. This show's back at the same time tomorrow. Join us then. Goodbye.